Yeah, but I mean, the thing is, like, at the heart of the internet psyche is the raid. So, yeah. Like, it's. I mean, it's already there. I mean, thinking, if you think about the storming of the Capitol, I mean, I'm sitting here in London, and I'm sure it's, like, far more scary to be living in America. But, like, if you think about it as a instantiation of internet meme culture and it being a raid, it makes far more sense as to how it even, like, became a thing. If that makes any sense. Like, like you say, they did it because, it, you know, in some sense, it's for the lols.
I first heard JMO before I knew there was a JMO. It was on the Interdependence podcast, and he was talking about Solarpunk. I was walking the dog. This was during lockdown. And I'd walk the dog and listen to the whole podcast while walking the dog, and I was partially paying attention. And then I heard someone say Solarpunk, and I was like, wait, solar what? What's this? And I listened while walking, and then I rewound to listen again, and I was struck by something that's embarrassing to say, which is this. I really hadn't spent time building a near future world in my imaginary that was all that much distant from the near future that I really grew up within, which was cyberpunk. It had just never occurred to me, and that made me reflect on what has to be one of the more existentially important features of the imagination, which is that, well, it's able to see other possible worlds. The future and our imagination about the future is forever in flux. I mean, the future I grew up within was all about nuclear annihilation, and then it was the climate apocalypse, which I now realize made it seriously difficult to find hooks into much else. My own future imaginary was formed at a time such that it was somewhere in between the end of the world and a glittering perfect Star Trek utopia. To hear about a different future imaginary from the vantage point of a generation that grew up in a different world full of different perspectives, opinions, politics, actions, that was all incredible. I felt a bit naive listening and learning about Solarpunk, and I guess I truly enjoy occupying that kind of mind, listening and learning, my mouth slightly slack, smiling inside at the ingenuity and the creativity of the imagination to be able to wonder about other possibilities. So that's all a long way of saying that I knew that someday I'd like to meet this JMO character. I don't remember exactly how, but he found his way into the Near Future Laboratory community through that side window, I guess, of our Discord, and I'm glad he's here. I'm equally glad to have him as a guest on this episode 22 of the Near Future Laboratory podcast. And here's something that I never really thought I would say, but I'm excited to say it. But first, a word from this episode's sponsor, Deep Meat, the sustainably harvested game meat.
Once in the deep past, you had to work for a good meal, had to venture out and test your speed and strength against the beast, to win your right to eat with your own hands. Those meals just tasted better. Some say it was all in your head, but we know the truth. The flavor of the hunt is in the meat itself. No hormones, no scents, no farms, just the taste of the wild. Harvested using ancient indigenous stocking rites, Deep Meat offers the world's most sustainable, most authentically natural, non-algorithmic, pre-artisanal protein, exclusively unminted and unsequenced. From spear-caught salmon to hand-choked elk, we deliver the taste of humanity's wild past with all the seamless user experience of a pneumatic prime fridge delivery. Ask your Siri or other bybot about Deep Meat, exclusively from the Filthy Lucre Discord.
And now, here's my conversation with JMO, aka Jay Springett. Well, this was a long time coming. I feel like,
Not really,
but you know, looking forward to it.
Officially, like the least accomplished and interesting person that you've had on so far. You just had that like FRSA RDI guy on.
That guy. He's a bum.
Yeah, from Google X. Yeah, exactly. Now you're speaking to JMO.
I feel like what you did with your podcast is kind of like
it feels like a little bit from the future. It doesn't feel like necessarily what you would expect.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I do listen to a lot of like classic hour-long podcasts, but individuals making podcasts by themselves are almost all shorter, you know? And like, I've been listening to a lot of writers who are writing kind of weird fiction and putting out their podcasts. And it's just like the length that it needs to be to fit the content sort of thing.
Like, yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, I mean, I started the podcast originally as a way to like write, like just, I wanted to produce something weekly as a cadence, as you know, just creatively create something. And then it turned into learning how to write for 4 years, write an essay a week within the constraints of it being 301 seconds in length,
yeah,
which is, you know, a 5 minute talk or a five, well, saying out loud in one take is usually about 8 minutes or whatever, but you know, once you've cut it down. But yeah. And so it was trying to, how do you fit the content to the 5 minutes? And then as it's kind of grown, I'm learning to write, I'm producing the audio, and now I'm doing the video version. So it's more of it's become an exercise in workflow almost, you know, trying to like figure out how do you do it as efficiently as possible?
Right. Yeah. Like, you know,
write a blog post, record the audio and do a video version, like all in one go sort of thing.
You know, I've had Ableton on my computer for ages. Like, this is a good opportunity to learn Ableton, but that's a project in itself. I try to find the way to layer projects on top of projects, which is one of the things that I admire about what you did with your podcast, which is, it's not just because you want to do a podcast, but also just skilling up on writing. I think that's so beautiful to say, I'm going to package this thing. It's going to have an output. It's not just going to be, I guess it would be more self-indulgent just to do it for yourself as opposed to putting an audience out there.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I don't think I would have done it if it wasn't going to be public. The original goal was just to do something every week, and then the container and everything sort of fell into place. And then the first couple I was doing without script, I was just speaking to, I was really inspired by, I can't remember who did it, but many years ago now, there was a guy who made a podcast every day, and it was called like JFDI for like Just Fucking Do It. And it was like three or 4 minutes, or some were longer. And it was just a guy like talking about his day in a tech startup and what his life was like and what he was doing. And I was like really inspired by that. But then I was like, no, I want to do something a bit more polished, so I might as well learn how to write.
Yeah.
Being super dyslexic. So I've only really been writing in like since I started the podcast, to be honest.
Yeah. And that now you're like a writer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Getting commissions and everything.
It's amazing. You showed me, I hope this was you, because otherwise I've been telling this story to people and completely lying, but you showed me like a picture of like maybe like a flat or a squat in Berlin with a computer in the back.
Yeah. The mining rigs in London. That's in like right. 2016. Yeah.
It wasn't Berlin. It was London. I put Berlin because I added a little edge to it. In the movie version, we're going to do it in Berlin. Okay.
Well, I mean, it's more interesting if it's London though.
And there's something about that it was, and I think we were talking about that, but maybe could you tell me that story? Like, what was up with that computer?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it goes like the origin story, I guess, is like, there's a place in London called Limazulu. It's not there anymore, but it used to be a co-live working space. And the sort of people that live there are all really big authors and artists and musicians now. But at the time, they were all recent graduates. And in that space they used to do Petra Kutcher nights, and they used to run dinners. And those dinners were, you know, really super interesting. And there's like multiple verso books began life as dinner table dinner table conversations in that spot. And everyone who kind of lived there were really cool. And there's all sorts of like politics that were kind of like organized around that space. And I began with a couple of people who live there. I used to run a thing called the Thought Menu, which was a kind of like a short lightning talk series. We did about 14 of them over a couple of years on various subjects. And they were like 5 minutes. You had 5 minutes to speak, basically. So that was the energy in the space in London at the time, kind of like really early 2011, 2012, I guess.
Yeah.
We started Thought Menu in 2012. But yeah, and I remember just like the conversations around Bitcoin back then were, I remember having the first in-depth conversation about proof of work on a on the NHS process on the Westminster Bridge with a whole bunch of activists. And we were talking really in depth about proof of work. And that was like, yeah, that was the first big cryptocurrency conversation that I had, was at that protest. Meanwhile, literally behind us, they were organizing the Occupy London. The Occupy London guys were organizing, and it was like 5 days before they occupied outside St. Paul's Cathedral.
Yeah.
So that was kind of like really early. I mean, people were talking about Bitcoin, and, you know, there were like lots of people were talking about that at the Occupy London protests and stuff like that. It was all kind of like in the mix. Yeah, it was all like left activists that I was speaking to about it. And then, yeah, and then we just started, there was meetups and, you know, people were talking about it. And of course, Silk Road was like enormous then. And if people listening haven't read American Kingpin, that book is amazing, basically. really worth reading.
And why do you mention it in this context?
Because it's the history of Dread Pirate Roberts, or Ross Ulbricht, and how he got into kind of libertarian techno politics and started the Silk Road, and, you know, like everything that happened, everything that went down with the Silk Road. And yeah, and like for a period in London, it was like, you go to a party and it was just drugs off the dark web, you know, like that was early Bitcoin, to be honest. Like that was just like how you were paying for it sort of thing, you know? And then from there, it was just always in the air basically. And like, I remember like pre-Ethereum being launched, when the first white paper came out, there were loads of discussions about, you know, the difference between proof of work and proof of stake, you know, with Ethereum's eventual, you know, intention of going proof of stake. And all of these like semiotic questions of money around, around whether proof of stake is like, has the same qualities of digital money as proof of work. And many of the same conversations that are happening now on a much wider scale were, you know, they were all happening in 2013, 2014 or whatever. But most of the people I think that we're speaking to were all really interested in the technology and devs, essentially. There used to be a squat on, I think it was Bethnal Green, and that was all inhabited by actual Bitcoin hackers who have all got like early commits on the repo.
Yeah. Yeah. And what were you doing at the time that this was kind of swirling around you?
I was leading a double life. mysteriously. So I mean, this is like the real origin story is that I graduated with a degree in philosophy of the arts. So I studied music and philosophy together, and I graduated in 2006. And while I was at uni, I got really interested in copyright and wrote a lot about aesthetics and Disney owning everything and you know, ownership of culture and folklore and so on and so forth. And then I just worked at a bookshop for a while, and then they managed to get a job, got out of borders basically. And got a job working for just doing data entry at this company that I had like no interest in, but then the economic crash happened, the 2008 crash. So there's no job prospects anywhere. Yeah. Sort of thing. So I had an accidental career at a psychometric testing company that eventually was kind of through various mergers and buyouts turned into a Gartner owned company. And yeah, was learning about corporate culture and, you know, corporate organizing and kind of all of that sort of semi-seeing like a state, you know, metrics and dashboards and, you know, shifting corporate culture through hiring practices and so on and so forth. But to be honest, it wasn't, I did often wonder what the hell I was doing there. Yeah. So I was having this accidental career, learning how to be a project manager. I was managing, before I left, I was managing projects that were like millions of pounds end to end. Tech consultant, like learned how to do like all of those essential skills, and then bounced around startups after being headhunted from there. Meanwhile, because I had absolutely no interest in my day job, I was kind of involved in, well, as I said, I was doing the Thought Menu at Lima Zulu and various other places, and was involved in, got involved in this project called Edge Riders, which is kind of still around, although it's very different to what it was in 2012. And that was funded by the Council of Europe, and got to go to Europe and kind of meet all of these digital activists from all around Europe. And that was in 2012. And I remember a guy called Matthias holding up a physical Bitcoin, which is something that you could have back then. It had like a QR code and a peely piece of foil to reference it, basically. So you could like give someone a physical Bitcoin, and he held one up in the Council of Europe and was asking the lawmakers there about what they thought about Bitcoin, and they didn't have any opinions of it. And I was like, oh boy, like this is going to be like, I couldn't believe they didn't have any opinions about it.
Do you think that they didn't have opinions because they didn't know it, or they didn't understand it enough to have an opinion, or just they're kind of
both
about it?
Just both. Yeah. You know, I don't think that they even had any idea of what it was going to turn into.
Right.
And then, yeah, so I just had this kind of like, I guess like art world, music world adjacent life outside of work. And in 2013, I coined the term stacktivism for my sins, which got me really interested in infrastructure and politics and, you know, how infrastructure influences our daily lives and kind of what those things mean. And obviously like decentralization technologies and, you know, peer-to-peer foundation events and so on and so forth. And then the art world got really interested in infrastructure in about 2014. And I co-curated some residencies and various things like that. What does that
mean? The art world got interested in infrastructure. What's the infrastructure?
Well, I mean, stacktivism kind of became a term that the art world was using to talk about emerging technology and specifically infrastructure and the relationship that we have to it.
Okay.
Meanwhile, the rest of the art world is talking about, pouring loads of money into making the word Anthropocene a thing. It was around that time, if you remember. So there was a segment of the art world got really interested in infrastructure. Obviously, like James Bridle was making work then, and sure, Georgie Voss, and you know, all sorts of people. iBeam, like they were doing kind of related events as well.
Yeah.
And then I gave a talk in 2014 at Theorizing the Web about stacktivism and stacks and kind of nation states, and mentioned Dogecoin being a dystopian future, which was good. And then through my interest in kind of, stacktivism itself was my first, I guess my first go at creating a hashtag, because hashtags really fascinate me as an object. I mean, they seem really mundane now, but it was less than a decade ago that they were very new and exciting, and full of, they have so much potential to kind of like coordinate around, and they have these weird network effects that allow, you know, separate people to gravitate around a term. That's why I'm fascinated by fandom, because they kind of they use these hashtags as these aureate like objects that kind of sit within their mental space, if that makes any sense.
Can you dig into that a bit? So what is it? So I get the idea in principle, and I can definitely appreciate the potential for kind of super nerding out in a kind of philosophical slash theoretical way about the power of hashtags as a kind of, as a kind of social architecture, or maybe more like bathroom grout, like it's going to hold a bunch of things together. Mm-hmm. And that sort of evolving out of the understanding of memes, I guess, generally. And then that the whole, I guess there was a component of Web 2, I suppose, that was about, tag clouds, in other words, user generated semantics and that kind of thing. So was there
also, I'd say, like early post internet art as well. Sorry to cut you off. Really early post internet art. There's garden.club, if you remember that. And there was lots of the Tumblr surf clubs from the early 2010s, which were all kind of like artistic gestures towards like creating vibes and genres. So there was like garden.club was one of them. And there was all sorts of different surf clubs where people were adding like collective blogs run by various artists that were trying to make, I don't know, just make up a word like Cyber Night or something, you know, they were just trying to make Cyber Night a thing.
Yeah.
As an artistic practice or whatever, you know, like all of that sort of thing really fascinated me. And I was like, oh, well, if these things are like theory objects, and that's what I called stacktivism, and I didn't really define it. I just said stacktivism is a conversation about, we can't have a conversation about things whilst they remain unseen. I gave a couple of talks about infrastructure and then just let it go out into the world. And now you can put it in Google Scholar and find it and, you know, like all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
And then I got involved in Solarpunk.
Yeah. So I want to get to that. I want to close out the, or just maybe backfill a little bit in with the stacktivism. Can you give your explanation of it?
That was it from my perspective. I gave a couple of talks about infrastructure and how, who owns the means of not dying rather than who owns the means of production. It's probably like a really crucial question, and I thought it was quite urgent at the at the turn of the last decade, let's say like 2011, 2012, 2013. I thought it was a very urgent question that we should be asking ourselves as kind of like a political gesture, let's say. We should be talking about infrastructure more. And now a decade later, here we are, and there's like, the infrastructure bill is going through, which probably should have happened 10 years ago. From my perspective, it was an exercise in trying to create gravity and momentum around a particular term, right, as opposed to defining what a term is and then putting it out into the world. Because I saw what happened to Bridal's new aesthetic. So that if that's going to happen, then there's no point in defining something. You just create a container and tell people to put stuff in it, right? Basically.
The new aesthetic thing was kind of brilliant. I'm sort of understating. It was really brilliant. It was particularly exciting sort of being a bit close to James at the time. I'm not saying that we've fallen out or anything, but he did move to Greece and grow a mustache. But at the time, you know,
it's like got lots of plants.
Yeah, we were chatting a lot, and I just remember being in a really kind of almost like fraternal way, just like proud, just like, this is amazing. I mean, you've built something that has it really feels like it's got legs and it's got meaning. And yeah, it was amazing. I haven't thought back on that in a while.
Yeah. I mean, and the thing is, though, just to kind of bring it back to kind of a conversation around crypto, the guys from Other Internet wrote that Headless Brands essay back in 2019. Yes.
I nerded out. I went deep on that.
Yeah, it's a very similar process that, like, you know, what they're describing, I think, is the first time I've ever seen kind of what I've tried to do in practice, written down as a strategy. And I mean, you see it, like, it's so true, like Bitcoin and all of these like huge global brands, no one's steering the ship. Yeah. It's great.
Thanks for bringing that up. I haven't thought about that since hearing about it and then reading it during quarantine. So basically just kind of sitting in a room. But I remember what resonated with me about it was that at the time I was effectively running a brand, which was my own company, sort of on my own, and just realizing that a lot of what the brand meant, there was only so much I could control. And so much of it was just coming from the audience and the owners mm-hmm. of the product. They were just wrapping themselves around it. And since most of the brand expression was coming through on Instagram and essentially me reposting photos that other people had taken, because I didn't have the time or energy to go out and do like entire photo shoots on my own. That's why I was happening. I remember just really loving this idea of the headless brand. Even before I read the paper, read the essay, just hearing about it. Mm-hmm. And what does that mean? Yes, of course. You know, just this.
Yeah. And the fact that they have concrete examples that are 10 years old to point to is really fascinating in terms of like how important it is. On the Interdependence podcast a couple of weeks ago, and I forget who it was that said it, but someone was like, we're only like 5 years away from companies having their community officers sitting like chief community officer as a position, like in the senior management team of large organizations, especially if you've got that kind of momentum where audiences are steering the brand somewhat.
Yeah. I think it was the latest, if I remember correctly, maybe the latest episode that with Jess Loss from Seed Club, who I learned about listening to that, but I also remember becoming a little bit, it was almost one of those episodes like, I better pull a car over. I shouldn't be distracted. But just this idea that it was almost, it was something that I don't know if it was said there, or maybe I've been also kind of sensitive to it, that the community manager becomes like the kind of head of brand in a way.
Yeah.
For a collective or a group, but also kind of like quite with a light touch. So in other words, you can't actually, brand books will have that thing. It's like, here's how to use the logo and here's not how to use the logo. It's just kind of like, forget about that.
Ethereum just has that one SVG file, right? Yes. And that's the brand.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think it's just going to be companies though. Like I have that power fandoms, like idea, or just as a term, I think it's a useful term. And I know that, there's been lots of talk for almost a decade, especially with like Henry Jenkins and so on and so forth, talking about fandoms creating their own IP, but
Kevin Kelly and all that.
Yeah. But I mean, Creative Commons is awesome, but also it's complicated when it comes to money as a license. And it's one of the reasons why I am actually like quite excited about kind of various Web3 technologies, because we may end up in a position where, fans or communities of people will be creating their own worlds and licenses as they have always done, but now they can get paid and return value to the community that's creating them. However that happens, I mean, we're going to have, all these hybrid licenses that people are going to have to just invent and try and take flack for, but you know what I mean? Like, it's just going to, the only way that these things are going to get created is if people do them.
Right. Yeah.
Especially like the Loot projects or whatever, I mean, however, I haven't looked, but like if you look up how much of the Loot treasuries are worth for all the different Loot projects, even despite where like the market right now, it's still got to be like hundreds of millions of dollars worth of value is like tied up in the idea of Loot. And that's what kind of, for me, it's what power fandoms are, they're like these coordinated groups of people that are going to be able to come together, share a treasury, make decisions, credit each other's work, retain the value from that work. They won't necessarily need publishers and distributors, so on and so forth. Legal agreements will be agreed on chain. And then who knows what's going to get created? Video games.
Yeah.
Audiobooks.
Yeah. Man, I got to tell you, when you did your podcast episode, where you talked about that, that was one of those ones. I was in a particularly thorny stretch of crumbling LA infrastructure when it clicked. And the, one of the beautiful things about your podcast is that it's compact enough that you can be like, I'm going to listen to that again. And you can listen to it again straight away without having to kind of search for what part. I'll just start the whole thing over. But you, the way you clarified it with the Loot project in particular, it just snapped into focus. And then I subsequently found out that to a certain degree, I mean, I was making this up. It's like, of course, Jay is going to see this because another podcast you had talked about some early days when, you know, you were super into like, you know, board gaming. And just in the mm-hmm. case of that and how, and I immediately reflected on my much more limited exposure, but awareness of the, you know, the kind of, the particular kind of consciousness or imagination that you need to bring to these games where it's, you got to put some work in. You got, this is like, this is the beautiful kind of like physical fitness gymnasium for the imagination. Is to play yeah. kinds of games. And then it all snapped in like Loot. I get it now. I get the, you know, from me being a kind of computer nerdy kind of thing, like composability, I get it. Like you're just providing the seeds, but then the link was to the right kind of audience that is anticipating without saying what this will become. So yes, of course I want a bag of loot. What'd you get? I got a sword. I got an open mitt and I got a spatula. Oh yeah. Cool. That's amazing. I think mm-hmm. I think I'm going to go back and get another bag. Is the guy still there? You know that?
Yeah. 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 I mean, the thing is the process of, I mean, because if you think of the process of the way that headless brands kind of evolve through the mechanisms that, that the guys like laid down, Bitcoin and Ethereum themselves are the same thing as Loot in a sense. They're this like dynamic world that has like created value. And, you know, the I don't remember who said it, but it was one of my favorite tweets of last year is that the entire cryptocurrency phenomenon is that scene from Hook where the Lost Boys sit down and imagine their, they wish, when they wish their dinner into existence.
Yeah.
In Neverland, like that's literally the entire history of the last decade of cryptocurrencies is nerds wishing the dinner into existence.
Yeah.
And a whole bunch of electricity.
And a whole bunch of electricity. Yeah. Which is that, that, yeah, it's another whole thing.
I think proof of work actually is probably be better, is probably be better to think about proof of work in the crypto space as computing's first industrial accident.
Mm. Yeah.
Like in terms of it's like an oil spill or something, you know, proof of work is a huge industrial accident that, you know, that has kind of got out of control.
Yeah.
But it's only like 0.01, whatever. I say it's only, but you know what I mean? It's, yeah. it's actually like 0. Whatever it is of percent of the world's electricity use.
Yeah,
we throw 60% of the stuff that we create away. So,
right. Yeah. Well, there was I had this idea kind of popped in my head at Monday morning meeting this morning as I was trying to think of projects to work on in the Discord for the Filthy Lucre project. And one was it's like, oh, we should there needs to be in our kind of world that we're constructing. There needs to be like a toxic waste dump. That's just filled with like kind of, you know, torn, crushed and kind of broken up. Apes and crypto punks and kind of, you know, festering and moldering throwaway generative NFT projects. And it's, you know, you frame it as a thing. It's like, yeah, I mean, kind of didn't know what we were doing at the time and, you know, incredibly regretful and we're trying to mitigate the outspill from this, but it's a forbidden zone in a way, you know, you can almost see it visualized in a way, just like a, yeah. But you framing it that way to say, yeah, it was a mistake. And, you know, like a generation on, there's like a certain amount of kind of collective regret and guilt around it.
You know? I think there is a lot of regret and guilt around it, but at the same time, none of this would exist without proof of work.
Yeah.
I've been writing an essay and Bitcoin is like the mother of all chains in some sense. And like, yeah. I mean, what we're going to do about it is one of those questions. It's like, well, what do we do about, you know, Pripyat and Chernobyl. It's literally the same kind of question. Like, you know, it's really hard. Like, we can't, like, you can't just legislate it. You can't just legislate the computing's biggest industrial accident away, you know, like it's not gonna go away.
Yeah.
Why do you think, so do you have any opinion on proof of work versus proof of state from proof of stake from a, you know, someone who's kind of been around this for a while, I guess more from the perspective of like, which operates better as a way of instantiating value?
Well, I mean, in order to make the cognitive leap that any of it has value, you have to go through proof of work.
Yeah.
Which is why Bitcoin will never move away from proof of work ever. But there's the in order to make that leap to say that all of the rest of the ecosystem has value, it has to be pegged in some sense against proof of work and energy expenditure. There's really good essay by Wasim, who runs the Zero X Salon in Berlin, and he calls Bitcoin the indifference engine. Oh, who's that? Good boy.
That's Chewy the dog.
Chewy. As in like Han Solo's Chewy, or Chewy. Yeah. As in like,
yeah, the cats are too. So it kind of works out.
Yeah. Awesome. But yeah, so Wasim has an essay called The Indifference Engine, where he talks about how, you know, the Bitcoin network doesn't actually care about its energy, expenditure, because it has no way of like understanding it. And he goes into that essay, he introduces the term thermopolitics, to talk about, like, if you want to talk about proof of work, systems, then you have to, you know, what you're actually doing is talking about thermopolitics. And that can get, if you want to get into thermopolitics, then there's a whole bunch of stuff in this world that, you know, like, starts to look really dicey when you get into the, you know, the idea of thermopolitics.
Yeah. Amazing. I hadn't heard about that. I'll have to look it up.
Yeah. It's definitely worth looking into, but then also when we're talking about proof of stake, and you know, this is like one of those discussions that, you know, we could spend an hour talking about just in on itself, but there's loads of different types of proof of stake. And unless you're in the weeds, like, you're not going to know. And, you know, they all have their various different, benefits and problems. If that makes any sense.
Yeah.
I mean, we can go into them. There's like proof of stake, which is kind of like the regular proof of stake, where the next block is chosen via, you know, various like random selections of who's running what software. And, you know, sometimes this is based by how long your node's been on the network. Sometimes it's based on, you know, depending on, you know, the delegatory architecture of the proof of stake system. But then there's like delegated proof of stake, which is, you know, where coin holders send their money to staking nodes. And there's leased proof of stake as well, where a delegated proof of stake is basically where they take the top pools of money of people who are running nodes. It's like the top 20 or whatever, like, and they're the people who are responsible for the network. And if they fuck it up, then they lose their money. And then there's least proof of stake, which is kind of like what you get with Polkadot and so on and so forth, where you can lease your money to someone else and then you get returns based on, you know. And then there's like a couple of others. There's like Masternode, which is like, it's not as decentralized, but you have this node staking. And yeah, there's, you know, but who's going to know? Like, unless you actually like dive into the architecture of the system. But it's also the same question as, do you care if your Web2 application is running Hadoop or Bigtable, right, or whatever? You know, it's like, we're talking about databases.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, that was quite a lot.
No, I like that. It was just making me think of, you know, sort of like perpetually surfing the curve of what's going on and who's out there and stuff. And I was just listening to a podcast this morning while walking to Monday morning meeting, and it was like, I'm not really interested. It's okay. But then they jumped into their next topic which is something called sheep game. And I hadn't heard of it, but so I'm like listening, and there's a thing called Wolf Game running on Ethereum, and
yeah,
it was doing so well because it was running on Ethereum and gas, and some people moved it on to Avalanche and did the sheep game. And I was just going, it's a game. I'm sort of interested in game mechanics, and just in this, I'm not going to explain it right or well at all, but just the fact that they were describing, it's like they're wolves and they're sheep, and you could get a wolf or you could get a sheep. If you have a sheep, it could be eaten by the wolf, or you could stake the sheep by putting it in the barn, and the sheep would earn your wool. And just that little mechanic, I was like, this is awesome. This is, yep. They're describing like, you know, like DeFi mechanics, but with sheep and wolves and barns.
And then just make it Farmville, and like history repeats itself, but this time the people playing it are getting paid.
Yeah. It was
instead of Zyngaia, you know, like instead of Zyngaia making all the money.
the thing that kind of went in my head was that's the moment when someone, you're saying like, I've read about it and I've listened to it. I'm just not getting DeFi. And someone's like, okay. Imagine you've got sheep and you've got wolves. Okay,
yep.
Good. Now, okay, cool. Keep going. And there's a barn. Yeah, there's a barn, of course. Who's in the barn? Well, there's a farmer with a pair of shears. And it's just one farmer, so he can't shear everyone at once. So you might have to, it takes time to shear. And once you get sheared, you get to take the wolf from your sheep and you take your wolf. Now, you could take a sheep outside, but it might get eaten by a wolf. And, and just the metaphor of it just made it feel like, aside from the game, you know, which is a real thing, just as an explainer, was kind of nice.
Yeah, that's really good. This time last year, I did a Come Internet With Me episode with Ruth Catlow from Furtherfield. Mm. And we looked up DeFi art, and it was just before NFT DeFi was a thing. So like, it's an interesting time capsule where we spend an hour basically Googling stuff and going down the rabbit hole on DeFi and art, basically.
Yeah.
It's worth, you know, having a look at.
Yeah. And it feels to me though, like, you know, it's game. This is an obvious point, I guess, but it's games or art where a lot of this important experimentation happens, which is consistent, I think, probably throughout human civilization, but definitely my experience, like the most interesting things that happened during web 1.0 or before were artists just kind of fucking around, where, you know, that era where you could like go onto a website because someone told you to, and they probably told you to like with their normal human voice, and then you would go to it and you'd be like, what the fuck is this? And it would just be like some mad experiment in browser mechanics or just even like, what is the purpose of this? And it's almost sad once the web kind of like got a particular kind of design aesthetic where it had to be useful, where UX. Ruined it.
I grew up on PHP forums and then MySpace, and you know, MySpace was wild, absolutely wild for that stuff, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting at the moment. Like, I mean, I'm really interested in governance. Well, I have been for years, like, you know, speaking about DAOs before Ethereum even launched. But, I guess they were DACs, originally distributed autonomous corporations.
Yeah.
But really interested in worlds and mechanics for governance and how large groups of people make decisions. I mean, that's what I'm really interested in at the moment. And the thing that I find really interesting is a couple of projects that I've been working on and would like to do more of it is how do you coordinate to say 10,000 people in a Twitch channel watching a live stream, and how do those people coordinate in order to affect the game that the stream is playing? You know, and we've been playing with these mechanics at, like, the Trust guys have been playing with some of these mechanics, but like, I really want to do a deep dive into this in much more detail, because there's a difference between voting in a DAO, you know, which is like, you know, just a very like stage process of yes or no, or, you know, most DAOs don't even have ranked choice preferences as governance modules inside them. They are, I mean, at the moment, kind of decision-making inside of DAOs is really crude. And you've basically got like three or four, I mean, things are going to be, get better as Zodiac releases more and more modules with the Gnosis Guild. But yeah, it's really crude. And earlier this year in January and February, me and some friends spun up every DAO platform that was going basically and had a look to see where it was. And our use case was basically reducing a long list to a short list and then eventually picking like a 1-2-3 winner. Basically that was the use case, and none of the DAOs could do that natively. But you know, all of that sort of stuff is coming. But when you're in a live real-time environment, how do you coordinate, like, beyond the kind of Twitch plays Pokemon anarchy versus democracy mode? Like, how do you, you know, this kind of swarm collaboration and making decisions and, you know, joining factions in real time from within the crazy chat, you know, and what does the UX look like for that? And all of this also comes out of my interest in like old school IRC and interactive fiction, because, you know, like all of those kind of mechanics kind of feel very similar. And yeah, and I was talking about this with someone the other day, actually. And I'm just gonna say why I think games, I'm sad to report that games might be where the future of governance takes like is developed, which is, you know, a bit sad. But there's a kind of like a bootstrapping process, which is where you have this virtual and online coordination.
Yeah.
Right. And, but it only has those stakes only have impact when there's kind of real world outcomes, but the real world impact of that can only happen when the coordination problems are solved.
Right.
Yeah. So there's like this, you know, this bootstrapping that's got to happen where virtual and online coordination needs to get better and better and better until like it has an effect in the real world. And then suddenly it has stakes in the real world. So it has to continue to evolve. But yeah, like how do 10,000 people make a decision in a chat within 3 minutes or 2 minutes about something, you know, go up, go down, go left or right? Beyond, you know,
is the game aspect that you're describing, is that because, is that from a like game theoretic kind of perspective or from like literally a game interface?
Well, it's both. It's the mechanics of coordination, of that kind of like large scale coordination or coordinative play is what I've been referring to it like in my work with some clients. It's like that coordinative play, the mechanisms that will be developed are going to be in every single Telegram channel and, you know, every single Discord, Slack, blah, 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 within, you know, within a matter of years, once those things actually get going, you know, because at the moment, think about trying to vote on something in Slack. You have polls or you can use emojis.
Yeah.
You know, and or you have to like leave Slack and go to Lumio and, you know, use their kind of like collaborative, deliberative, you know, interactions that they have on their platform. But yeah, like, and if you think about DAOs being the wrapper that can sit, like if a DAO is a chat channel with a bank account, you know, as a minimum viable product, then it means that we can make these decisions through mechanisms within the chat channel that are connected to the chain, you know? So all of these things happen on chain and then the results are recorded or right. however it works. But yeah, the real-time coordination really, really interested me. And, you know, how do you get tens of thousands of people to coordinate and make decisions and collaborate and be adversarial with each other within a, because the UX of the chat channel with a live video or a live virtual world is so ubiquitous now that, you know, Jemima just did that Doll's House project. You know, I don't know if you saw that, where he was doing a live Sims thing where he was like, the chat channel were deciding what he was going to wear and who was going to show up at the door. Is it the bear or the policeman? And they were buying him new rooms, which were like a full set that he had on a soundstage. And yeah, like all sorts of like crazy, crazy stuff is coming in terms of like entertaining the chat box, basically.
Yeah.
You heard it here first. One of the future of entertainment is entertaining the chat.
Yeah. I have no idea what you're talking about, but I can sort of picture these things in a way. Like I guess maybe just my visual mind starts imagining what the actual content of the chat is. You know, are things,
yeah, well,
things, stuff happening. It's not just kind of ideas being slung around or links being, hey, check this out, but some other.
Yeah. But it's also like live stream, especially like I wrote about this last year, or maybe it was 18 months. I can't even remember. Time is a flat circle at the moment, but I wrote a thing about synthespians and virtual avatars and talk about how, like, because they're playing these cartoon characters, their world is in some sense co-created with the chat channel. So the chat comes up with some meme that's related to the performer, or this is with most live streamers, right? Like chat comes up with a meme and then the meme feeds back in, right, into the streamer's world. And then that reinforces it. And as a performer or as a streamer, like if you're sitting there for 8 hours a day, you have to be very discerning about what you let from the chat through the membrane into the world that you are creating with your co-creating. Otherwise, you know, like things can go south, it's like this.
Sorry. So how does that work? Let's take it a little bit dark. Like if the mob gets to decide what you do, and if the mob can coordinate a la, the way the mob is wont to do at times, just to go to the dark side of its consciousness and say, hey, we're going to squeeze play AMC stock because it'll be fun. Or we're going to storm the Capitol, the US Capitol, because it'll be fun. You can start imagining this, you know, being, I guess, less more like a rom-com and more like a complete disaster.
Yeah. But I mean, the thing is, like, at the heart of the internet psyche is the raid. So yeah. It's already there. I mean, if you think about the storming of the Capitol, I mean, I'm sitting here in London and I'm sure it's like far more scary to be living in America, but like, if you think about it as a instantiation of internet meme culture and it being a raid, it makes far more sense as to how it even like became a thing. If that makes any sense. Like you say, they did it because it, you know, in some sense it's for the lols.
I never thought about it that way, but that makes clarifying.
Considering how they've all had their brains rotted by like Facebook meme culture, like,
yeah,
or whatever, or wherever it is that they're like the Q forums. I mean, some of these people were going on 9GAG to get their Q news, you know, yeah. Like, yeah, crazy.
So what do you think? What do you think your morning looks like in 10 years?
Yeah, that's a good question.
It's a really good
out the blue. Well, I don't know. I mean, being in the UK, if
talking about.
Yeah. Being in the UK, if the Tories sell the NHS and I can't get my meds for my incurable illness that I have, which is Crohn's disease. So, you know, who knows if I'll even be around in 10 years, but being a solar punk, I like to think that in 10 years time, part of my morning is going out and going to the community market garden or tending the chickens, the community chickens in the park down the road or whatever. I think for me, in terms of like group quality of life, I think that that kind of retro suburbanization, solar punk regreening of the suburbs. And if you're in the US, then it's kind of, you need to do sprawl repair and redensify your suburbs and create new small towns from, you know, within the suburbs. But yeah, like that kind of walkable city, green. Hopefully I won't be looking at the internet until lunchtime, let's say.
Right. And why are you hopeful for that?
Because otherwise we're fucked. Like just in general, like locally grown food. I mean, with the supply chain crisis.
Sorry, I meant that you won't be looking at the internet until after lunch.
Lunchtime. I just think it would be much healthier. I should probably start that tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm tracking what you're saying. I do want to, because the other nice, I don't know if it's serendipity or just the way things happen, is that I do remember listening to the Solarpunk Interdependence. I don't even know, like you said, time is a flat circle. I can't remember if it was like this summer that just,
I think it was this time last year or something.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I remember listening to it twice, cause I was like, I was excited and also like a little bit embarrassed. Like, I haven't heard of solar punk, but I'm a generation that grew up with cyberpunk, and that's it. That's where it ended in terms of, you know, the dominant visions of possible futures. So I was super excited that there was this other one, which I guess should have expected, because the world never ends with what I think about. But yeah, so tell me that story. I know you've told me before, but for the podcast, what's the cyberpunk? I mean, the solarpunk story.
Well, I mean, solarpunk is a growing movement, I guess, in speculative fiction, art, design, fashion, activism, technologists that are interested in what a sustainable, I guess you would say regenerative now, like when we originally wrote the descriptions, regenerative was not the buzzword, right. But yeah, basically what's interested in what does a sustainable civilization look like and how do we get there? I usually define it as like, it doesn't necessarily have to be utopian, but it is at least something that is en route to a better world.
Mm-hmm.
And it began as there's lots of talk. If anyone would like to go on my blog, there's lots of talks that I've given about like the history of solarpunk and where we are now. But it really began life in 2012 as part of a trilogy of books in Brazilian Portuguese, where solarpunk was one of a trilogy that also included atom punk and diesel punk with a call for short stories. But the word solarpunk is one of those terms that when you hear it, you immediately know what it means in terms of like the imagination in the way and what it can do. And a guy called Adam Flynn founded or spun up the Solarpunks Tumblr in 2012 and kicked it off with an essay called On the Need for New Futures, where he basically says that we don't have any futures to call our own. Mm. And he asked a whole bunch of questions in that essay in 2012. What's its aesthetic look like? Is it a flag? Is it a setting? Is it a D&D setting? Is it a world? Are we doing collective world building, or is it all of these things? And he asked a whole bunch of questions. He references who I believe, you know, he referenced Justin Pickard's Gonzo Futurist Manifesto, mm-hmm. from way back. And also talks about Bruce Sterling's atemporality for the contemporary artists from his, I don't know, it was like, I think it was a Transmediale talk. But yeah, so it's a provocation, essentially, was solarpunk. What is it? What could it be? And of course, the solar in solarpunk does not just refer to the sun, but it also refers to decentralized solar power, you know, and the way in which solar panels on roofs actually work as an infrastructural technology. And he throughout his early material, he was talking about the mayor of Jacksonville, really famous, Choke Molumba. I think I'm going to murder that. I really apologize. But he basically says that the dealing in infrastructure is about building autonomous communities. And without your own infrastructure, you have no kind of self-determination, essentially. So you can see why these things sort of interested me in 2012, 2013-ish, because I was doing the whole stacktivism thing, like trying to create this container for ideas. And Adam was saying that he wanted to make solarpunk a thing, basically. That was what he was saying. And then, yeah, and we got chatting on a mailing list that had a whole bunch of super interesting people on it. And then, yeah. And then I joined the Tumblr in 2014. And then since then, just been community managing and, yeah, just watching it grow, really. It's amazing. Now there's like, last count, I think there's 14 anthologies at this point in 2021, and there's multiple language, like there's Italian solarpunk anthologies of like world solarpunk translated into Italian, and that's also like a very big part of its raising up of other people's voices, and you know, hearing alternate perspectives and so on and so forth is like a core value of solarpunk. And it's great to see publishers like now taking steps to publish work in translation, like, you know, making sure that there's, you know, 20% of what they're putting out is from voices from around the world, and yeah, so on and so forth. Yeah. Yeah, it's really, really fantastic. Yeah. And obviously like the aesthetics of solarpunk is something that keep changing depending on what is going into the container. Because in the early days of solarpunk, a lot of the images on Tumblr were like the Age of Sail, but with bicycles and solar panels sort of thing. That kind of spirit of yeah, like tea clippers, and right, people were posting like a lot of that sort of imagery. Concept art of tea cutters with like solar paneled sails, wooden yeah, right, boats with solar punk, you know, with solar sails and all of that sort of stuff. And then in 2014, a Tumblr user called Miss Olivia Louise posted a Tumblr that was basically, here's a thing I've been thinking about for a while. And she basically wrote about Art Nouveau and arts and crafts, and she'd done some fashion sketches of what people may be wearing, and referenced some Japanese artists like Imperial Boy and so on and so forth. And then that post went bananas and is still going bananas on Tumblr now.
Yeah.
And it's probably like the reference post for how Tumblr looked, or sorry, how solarpunk looked in mid-decade, last decade.
Right.
And yeah, and then of course you eco brutalism starts to sneak in, and you know, the solar punk community starts to decide about like, maybe we don't like all of these, like one of the foundational things about solar punk is that it's reuse and remend, like mend and reuse rather than destroy it all and build something new, modernism.
Right.
So like, yeah, basically it's not a solar punk feature unless it's got people in it. It's like the, you know, if you want to do a quick test when you see a solarpunk image.
Yeah.
And it was actually quite funny because I was interviewed for the Vice article that came out, or the Motherboard article that came out about solarpunk earlier this year. And I say that in the article, and then they illustrate it with a picture of like an eco-brutalist piece of concept art.
Because it looked cool.
Yeah, typical.
Yeah. It's interesting. So let's just mark 2012 as an early Genesis moment. Was it 2012
That's when the book came out in Brazilian Portuguese, and Adam Flynn wrote that first essay.
Yeah. So yeah, a little bit of a kind of manifesto moment with some merch. Do you feel like there's Do you sense or see that coming into a kind of material consciousness, as opposed to, not as, you know, these are super slippery lines, but you know, let's just be you know, a bit rash dash to say, like there's the imagination of this world as expressed in literature, you know, science fiction, maybe, and it's beautiful that people are having a hand at creating visual, you know, articulating their kind of imagination, yep, in visual form, creating renderings and concept art and that kind of stuff. I love that. And then it kind of, is there like a transformation or like a transfer function where it begins to exhibit itself in material culture? So people actually doing things that in order to,
yep,
create this world.
Yeah. So one of the things that I tend to go to, especially with journalists, when they ask me about solarpunk, is that, unlike other kind of fandoms, is that the thing about solarpunk is a lot of its aesthetics, like the core aesthetics around, you know, permaculture gardens and keyline design, and you know, which is a whole like 16 year olds on Tumblr reading like all about agroecology and mixed use farming and Yeoman's keyline design, and you know, getting super into water flow, and yeah, it's really cool to see. But a lot of those aesthetics arise from praxis that is in the real world today.
Yeah,
Like that's one of the key things. So solarpunk in some sense is its role or its job is to take the things that already exist or things that have been traditionally overlooked and then project them forwards in the minds of the people that are, you know, it's prefigurative in some sense, you know? Yeah. And one of the things I always talk about is that like, you can't LARP solarpunk in the same way as you can LARP cyberpunk or, you know, cosplay steampunk.
Yeah, what, so why?
To LARP solarpunk is to go plant a garden.
Yeah.
Or as has happened in real life is start a seed sharing library in an old phone box in your town or, you know.
So you're saying you can't do that?
No, I mean, that's exactly what it is, right? Like you can't LARP solarpunk. You just go out and
you just do
plant
it.
A garden.
Got it. You're not role playing.
Yeah. Like
you're
the playing seed it. You're doing it. Yeah. Yeah. Guerrilla gardening is the model in some sense, you know, like.
It almost feels like then it does need like a veneer of LARPing. Like, you know, just to add that little bit of, no, I'm not doing what you thought I was doing. I'm actually doing something that's a little bit from the future. And it should almost add a little element of like of confusion to the exercise. So
I'm instantiating the future today, right? Yeah.
And it can't just look like a regular garden box, or it can't just be represented as a regular garden box.
But the thing is, if you're into permaculture and you plant a permaculture garden on your street, you're like, it doesn't look like a traditional garden. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, like with your rainwater harvesting and your fruit trees and, you know, all of your cover crop and so on and so, it looks like it's from the future.
This reminds me of a Natalie Jeremijenko project where she had gardens in gutters. Taking advantage of
all the rain garden stuff, right?
Yeah, I think that was Natalie.
And Olakan Jellifus as well, he's like a New York-based artist. He's really worth like checking out. He does all of these like concept art he did this kind of like Afrofuturist solarpunk New York.
I think I've seen that. Yeah.
And then he worked with a community garden and they create a community garden in, you know, on a patch of land on the corner of a block somewhere.
Yeah. If it's the same artist that I think I just saw on Instagram, with these kind of really compelling, almost like, as if seen from a drone rooftops in wherever, you know, Brooklyn someplace or whatever it was meant to represent.
Like somewhere like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and that's what's so exciting about it in some sense is that it's almost like, if you're exposed to these ideas through fiction or through art or through, you know, through the story, like the world building in some sense is supports the story. But at the same time, as soon as you know about community food gardens or key line design or water management or something, you know what I mean? As soon as you know about it, you walk down the street and then you see it everywhere, wasted space. Yeah. Or like space that could be way more productive, or you look at the suburbs and if you like, yeah, like all the sprawl repair work from DPZ, the architecture firm, and Tatiana Galieva and all of her work. Like as soon as you see the pictures before and after of her kind of like sprawl repair, then you just see it everywhere. You know, like these aren't just sites of intervention in the real world, but they are imaginative sites for intervention or vice versa in some sense, you know, like they're both sites for narrative and real world action.
Yeah.
And if you can explain it through one of the things that I was extremely lucky to work with some of the people after the Labour Party lost the last election. I say lucky. I mean, they lost the last election here in the UK. But one of the things that I was saying is that their manifesto had all of these like really good ideas in it, but they had absolutely no way of conveying what it actually meant to people on the doorstep.
Mm-hmm.
And you know the concept of like a vertical slice in video gaming where you like create the demo and it's like the full presentation, like all the way from gameplay to all the light shaders, and it's polished, but it's only like 5 minutes of game.
Okay.
And they take it to a game fair. So yeah, a vertical slice is basically like, you know, the whole game, like this is what the idea is sort of thing, like to show journalists about, you know, 3 years before the game actually comes out. narrative is a vertical slice. And what you have to be able to do is communicate policies on the doorstep and what it means to someone through for a sci-fi story, essentially, that you can say on the doorstep in less than 30 seconds. Like if you can get it down to 250 words, 300 word flash fiction, you know, for each policy and how and what it would mean in your local area. Like that's like, yeah, I think that would have a great deal of impact if you could do that, you know, if you actually had this kind of narrative strategy, which I was doing for doing some work around that, like a couple of years ago, like, yeah, how do you build a narrative strategy for so, like, I not so much selling ideas, but communicating them.
Yeah. No, I get it. I mean, as you're talking, I'm thinking of the, well, you know, this being, Los Angeles of the sizzle reel. Like, how do you create the thing that just essentially tells a story with enough impact and briefly enough that someone's like, mm-hmm. right, got it. You know, who's attached to it? Who's going to direct this? And that is truly a, you know, remarkable skill to be able to do that.
I mean, I can't do that. I try, but I think it's definitely something that people should be trying to do. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, if you really good short story writers, flash fiction writers, like they are hard to find, but if you know, got one on your team, you know, on your design fiction team, you know, or whatever, like
when you described it in the context of politics, my mind went to the Trump campaign for the next election here, which I'm not at all excited about. But I saw an image that someone had posted or a little video on Instagram of a Trump supporters full on bus. Like you see these campaign buses with this full mm-hmm. map of essentially, it looked like something Raphael would have painted, you know, back in the Renaissance, essentially telling a story with mm-hmm. epic proportions. So Donald Trump's head atop a bodybuilder's body, literally like rippling bare chest. And you know, it was all illustration, obviously. It was remarkably good in its schlockiness. You're like, there it is. That's all I need to see. It was a tableau that if you were prepared
mm-hmm.
to
like exactly.
a story in this visual illustration on the side of a huge bus, it's like, yes, you know, it's like people would take a selfie with that and continue mm-hmm. to propagate the story. So
I remember talking about this like before Trump, during the campaign, actually, I was talking with a couple of writer friends and you know, MAGA is a very compressed four-word story. Mm. You know, it's a very compelling four-word story. Yeah. But and we were just talking about it as a slogan, and it's remarkable.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's not a vertical slice though, because it doesn't actually tell you what we're gonna do.
Is it a horizontal slice that allows you to pour a lot of stuff in no matter what that thing is?
Yeah, it's a container, right? Like this, it is a hashtag, literally, you know.
Yeah, that just kind of plays on an evolutionary defect of the human mind.
yeah, this can be whatever you want it to be, you know, whatever it means to you.
Yeah. Cool.
Cool.
That's good stuff. Thank you.
Yeah, that was really fun.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Well, that's it. There he goes. Back out the side window, down the rickety drain pipe, back to his own real London life. I'd encourage you to follow JMO. You can find his podcast Permanently Moved wherever you find a podcast can be found, or, you know, directly on his so-called homepage on the web 2.0, thejmo.net. So it's the end of the year, and I was just reflecting on the podcast, and I realized that the first episode, well, that dropped almost a year ago, right in the midst of a fucked up pandemic, and I managed to keep it going, and I learned a shit ton along the way. I also started a newsletter, and I sold a company I built, and I started an online community, and there's Monday Morning Meeting, and In Real Life Community. I also developed a new platform for meaning making called General Seminar, a bunch of you come to that, and with a gang, managed to finish a real life book. Despite how fucked up these last 20 months have been, you and I have persisted, we've stayed creative, we've stayed engaged, and made some real-life shit. So with that, please consider supporting this podcast.
You can do so over at patreon.com/nearfuturelaboratory. We're also on this third web, and you can support us directly at nearfuturelaboratory.eth. You know, someone should just give that a try to see if it works. This has been episode 22 of the Near Future Laboratory podcast, with production support by the Wrecking Crew of Design Fiction. I'm talking about the whole gang in the Near Future Laboratory Discord, where we make products from the future. Deep Meat was written and read by Andrew Hudson. Doesn't mean Sam Elliott. If you want to find out more about design fiction, that's where you want to be, in the Near Future Laboratory Discord. Links are below. Okay, that's it. Everyone have an amazing holiday. I'm Julian, and I'm out.